From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Robert Siegel, and this is On Point. 200-plus years ago, when the Founding Fathers created the Constitution, they established three branches of government. No one branch would hold absolute power, certainly not the executive. What the Founders didn't want was another king. But here we are, at a time when many are crying out about the amount of power the president wields. So, on this President's Day, we'll see what history tells us about how far we've come. This hour on Point, the evolving office of the president. With us from Charlottesville, Virginia, is presidential historian Barbara Perry. She's director of presidential studies at the University of Virginia's Miller Center, where she also co-directs the Presidential Oral History Program. She has written or edited 14 books on presidents, first ladies, the Kennedy family, the Supreme Court, and civil rights and civil liberties. Among those books, she co-edited 42, The Presidency of Bill Clinton, and 41, Inside the Presidency of George H.W. Bush. Barbara, it's great to have you here. Thanks for joining us today.
Great to be with you, Robert.
Over recent decades, we have heard alarms over the imperial presidency, too strong, as in Richard Nixon. Later, over the imperiled presidency, too weak, as in Jimmy Carter. On balance, has there been a general increase in president power, or we say war-making or executive orders or invoking privileges, or is it more a pendulum that swings back and forth?
I would say a little bit of both, but probably more the former. That is that we have seen an accrual of power to the executive branch and certainly to the presidency, especially over the 20th century. But we can look back to presidents such as Lincoln in times of great crisis, that is a civil war, the country breaking apart, that, yes, he assumed a tremendous amount of power. But particularly in the 20th century, in part because of crises as well, the Great Depression of the 1930s and World War II in the 1940s, President Roosevelt, Franklin, that is, of course, assuming a lot of power, and the growth of the bureaucracy, which then coincided in the post-World War II period with the Cold War. So a tremendous amount of power coming to the president because of the Cold War and then the War on Terror from Bush 43 onward.
When we look to what the framers intended and compare with where we're at now, it seems central that the framers didn't anticipate a popularly elected president, and it was even a century or so before a presidential nominee actually got out and campaigned for himself. Do modern politics enable presidents to expand their power simply because the president is so well known and such a public figure?
You're absolutely on point, I would say, Robert, with that. And the presidential scholars look back and say the founders intended for us to have this constitutional presidency that would be guided by the Constitution itself, not only Article 2, which spells out fairly generally powers of the president with some specifics, but not to have him exercising powers that were very specifically set out in Article 1 for the Congress. And so they thought that the guidelines of the Constitution, the guardrails as we call them now, would cause this power to be checked and balanced at every turn. But there's a new form of presidency that comes along in the early 20th century, scholars have noted, and they call it the rhetorical presidency. Mm-hmm. And that is that presidents, even starting with Teddy Roosevelt and certainly taking off with Woodrow Wilson, with modern media, being able to reach the people directly. As you said, the founders really didn't want that relationship of direct relation between the people voting directly for the president. And they couldn't have foreseen, I think, the modern media and how presidents, and not only that, but modern travel, allowing presidents to meet directly with the people. And now we bring that through radio, television, and social media now.
And there's a difference between a president who interprets his authority as what is specifically cited in the Constitution and one who says if it isn't banned by the Constitution, he can do it.
Yes, and that goes back to Teddy Roosevelt particularly, although we can even cite an example of George Washington claiming for himself that what we see today being used, executive privilege, and saying, I can keep secret, I can keep confidential the conversations that I have with my advisors, my papers, et cetera. There's nowhere in Article 2 of the Constitution that says the president may do that, but the Supreme Court has recognized it, as it did particularly in the Nixon tapes case, although with limitations. But it is the case that in the 20th century with Teddy Roosevelt developed this concept of stewardship, the active presidency. And he said, as long as a power isn't forbidden to the president, I think the president should act with it. as much energy as Alexander Hamilton said and vigor as Kennedy might have said as possible, as long as it's not prevented in the Constitution.
That's a big difference. It's a very important distinction.
It is. And he was following, you talk about a pendulum. We see Roosevelt sort of kicking off that modern presidency in the early 20th century. But it was followed after Woodrow Wilson, the quiescence of the 1920s in the sense of having Harding and then Coolidge and Hoover, for that matter, who were more passive presidents who did not think that the federal government or the presidency should have that much power. That was what, in essence, caused the defeat of Herbert Hoover in 1932, because he wasn't doing enough to ameliorate the effects of the Great Depression.
Preparing for this hour, I went back to look at Arthur Schlesinger's 1973 book, The Imperial Presidency, and then the later introduction he wrote, which between the first edition and the last introduction, he had wavered in his thesis and then returned to it with more energy. But one distinction he made, I thought, that was interesting between the way that FDR, Franklin Roosevelt during World War II and the Depression, and Abraham Lincoln during the Civil War, the way that they expanded presidential authority, unlike others, was that they acknowledged that they were doing something that was temporary because of the emergency. There was the understanding, the explicit statement, that these powers will revert to the people after this emergency is passed. And Lincoln did not permanently deprive us of habeas corpus. It was a step that he took during the Civil War. There's a difference between that and claiming Article II says I can do whatever I want to do, which Nixon said and now Donald Trump has said.
Very much so. And in fact, a colleague of mine here at the Miller Center, Russell Riley, who co-chairs the Presidential Oral History Program with me, is writing a book called American Regicide, in which he has the thesis that after presidents take on this tremendous amount of power in wartime, the American people actually turn against that power, not just that the presidents relinquish it, we hope, but that the people sort of force them to relinquish it. And so you can see a weaker presidency after Lincoln in the post-Civil War period. Or look at Truman after FDR. And part of it was Truman just wasn't FDR, but he suffered.
And yet he took the country into war in Korea without congressional authority, I believe.
He did indeed, which of course then between that and Vietnam leads to the War Powers Resolution. So again, the good news is I think whether it's constitutional checking through Congress or checking by the people, that is the difference I think between what you just raised about Lincoln and FDR and this vision of, oh, Article 2 says I can do anything I want, or under Article 2, I say I can do anything I want.
Well, that is presidential historian Barbara Perry. What is your take on the evolving role of the president? Do you think the public wants a more restrained leader, or is a strong president what people think we need, at least if he's of the party that we like? How can we look to history to help us understand the role of the modern president? And Barbara Perry, let me put that question to you first. Do you think that the public actually likes the idea of separation of powers, or do Americans really want a strong president provided they agree with him and they voted for him?
That is probably the latter, that human beings are human beings and they like to have presidents who agree with them. So I think that while they might learn in civics class that checks and balances and separation of powers are a good thing, they want a president to be energetic and to be activist when they agree with him. And they certainly want that when there's an emergency. And when what happens if a tornado hits a town, people might have signs in their yard that say, get the government off our back. But as soon as the hurricane or the tornado hits, they're looking for the federal government to come in and help. And usually the president will go there and say, here I am. I've declared this a disaster area. You can now get help from the federal government. It's an ox goring question. You know, whose ox is being gored?
Yeah, the famous conservative writer Whitaker Chambers once, I think, turned down William F. Buckley initially on his request that Chambers write for the National Review, the beginnings then of this conservative paper, because he said in rural Maryland, he watched these very conservative farmers line up to collect their federal benefits. And he felt that the issue was really settled. Being against big government was a complete loser, although I gather Chambers ultimately went on to write for the publication. Let's turn to Ray, who's called from Limerick, Maine. What's your take on presidential power and when it's grown or whether it should have.
Hi, how are we doing? I think it has expanded significantly. And, you know, the Cold War was a lot, caused a lot of that. And now after the, after, you know, 9/11 and Bush, it's been a greater power grab. And now we have a president who doesn't understand our Constitution, doesn't understand his role as president, and he seems to think he's Lord Emperor. And that is dangerous.
Dangerous, you say. Well, we do have an idea, though, Barbara Perry, that was cited initially by, law professor John Yoo, whom we'd actually had tried to have in this hour, although he has a conflict. The unitary executive. It's an idea of a very, very strong president. And I gather it's one that's pretty popular with Attorney General Barr and President Trump.
Yes, and Vice President Dick Cheney also believed in this, and David Addington, who worked for him when he was vice president. So it really came on the scene in the Bush 43 era, I think, as a result of 9/11 and the ongoing war on terror. And it says this, that a president can actually sort of cast aside any laws that might attempt to limit his power over national security. And there's a strain of that in our constitutional interpretation by the Supreme Court. A lot of power for the president and some limits on the power of the president have come from the U.S. Supreme Court. We haven't talked about that third branch, as it's known, listed in Article 3 of the Constitution. But in a case in 1936 that FDR was involved in, he'd been given some power from Congress, and it was to slap an embargo on sale of munitions. And the court said, yes, he has the power to do that.
That's Barbara Perry. We have more to talk about. We're discussing the changing role of the president and expanding executive power because this is President's Day. I'm Robert Siegel, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Robert Siegel, and we're discussing the changing role of the U.S. presidency with Barbara Perry, a presidential historian and director of presidential studies at the University of Virginia's Miller Center. She's joining us from Charlottesville. And Barbara Perry, I'd like to begin listening to this bit of Barack Obama, what he said at a cabinet meeting in January 2014. This was into his second term, when he spoke to reporters about the executive power that he would take, if need be, to put his policies in place.
We are not just going to be waiting for legislation in order to make sure that we're providing Americans the kind of help that they need. I've got a pen and I've got a phone, and I can use that pen to sign executive orders and take executive actions and administrative actions that move the ball forward in helping to make sure our kids are getting the best education possible, making sure that our businesses are getting the kind of support and help they need to grow and advance.
Let's take that slightly mixed metaphor of using the pen to move the ball forward. Executive orders. I mean, Republicans cried foul at Barack Obama's reliance on executive actions because he'd lost majorities in Congress. And he could do that. Was he expanding the presidency's powers when he did so?
Well, he was not the first president to issue executive orders, so we need to say that up front. But you're right to say that because he had lost the Congress, and particularly on areas of immigration policy, as he said at the top of that clip, he wasn't going to wait. Well, good thing he wasn't going to wait, because if he had waited, he would have waited forever to get immigration reform passed. And so as we know, he used executive orders, DACA, for example, to try to reform our immigration system.
Yeah, DACA is an interesting case. It's saying in the course of enforcing our immigration laws, we don't deport everybody who in theory could be deported. Therefore, the choice as to who is deported is discretionary. And DACA will define a group of people who will not be deported. That's a very interesting use of presidential power.
It is. But let's talk about those checks and balances. You're not getting the check and balance in a sense through Congress, although you are. That is, if you don't want immigration reform or you don't want the kind of immigration reform that Barack Obama's administration wanted, then you're happy that Congress is not moving forward and particularly that Republicans are not moving forward. But also the other check and balance on executive orders, first of all, they usually end as the president leaves because if a president comes in who doesn't agree with them can just reverse them. But also, they can be challenged. As we know, Obama's immigration policies were challenged all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court.
You've written books or you've edited books about both President Bill Clinton and President George H.W. Bush. Would you consider them strong presidents, presidents who expanded presidential authority or not?
I would say that any president in the modern era is going to be considered strong. But let's think about those two particularly, Bush 41, George H.W. Bush. He's following Reagan. So right there, he sort of has the Truman problem that he's not Ronald Reagan. He's also got a Reagan wing of his party. So we got the political check as well on him. But let's look at the first Gulf War and how successful he was at that. He got the authorization of use of military force from the Congress to move forward with that. Very strong. But as the economy turns sour, he seems weaker and weaker.
Didn't he also say afterwards that he would have gone into – he would have joined the effort to push Iraq out of Kuwait, let it, even if he hadn't won the congressional vote?
He did, and he would have, I'm sure. Also remember, though, there was a strong international coalition of forces.
Yes.
and UN resolutions as well. So he was the internationalist supreme and using that authority as well. Let's also now think of Bill Clinton. We'll call him 42. And the fact that he had come into power with this sort of third way approach of taken from Tony Blair that remember one of his State of the Union addresses, the era of big government is over. Mm-hmm. And so kind of following the conservative movement in this country, even though he was a Democrat and a liberal Democrat, he had some political issues as well that were checking his power. And so I would say that both 41 and 42 don't necessarily massively expand the power of the presidency, but they certainly follow along the course of the modern 20th century presidency and into the 21st century eventually.
Now, I'd like to bring in another voice into the conversation, also from Virginia, by the way, since the state of Virginia is known as or was known as the mother of presidents. It's the birthplace of eight past presidents. We figured it's acceptable on President's Day to have two guests from Virginia. And also from Charlottesville is Saikrishna Prakash. He's a law professor at the University of Virginia and author of Imperial from the Beginning, The Constitution of the Original Executive, and also the forthcoming The Living Presidency, an originalist argument against its ever-expanding powers. Saikrishna, thanks for being available to us. Welcome to the program.
Great to be with you.
The originalist argument against its ever-expanding powers. Explain to us.
Well, so I think the modern presidency, at least as a matter of constitutional law, has clearly gone beyond the contours of the original presidency. And, you know, people see it most clearly in war powers where modern presidents feel that they can start a war without going to Congress. And you referenced Bush, but we've seen, you know, President Obama with respect to Libya, and then President Trump with respect to Syria, striking military bases in Syria. So modern presidents are told by their legal advisors that whatever may have been true in the 18th century is no longer true, and that the presidents can use rather significant uses of military forces overseas without a congressional authorization or declaration of war. But that process has been replicated in other areas as well. So in the book, I talk about how, with respect to lawmaking, presidents are really, you know, a junior varsity lawmaker that exists side by side next to Congress. And sometimes that lawmaking emerges from regulations or delegations from Congress, but oftentimes it just results from clearly erroneous interpretations of existing statutes. And so in area after area, the president has acquired new authority.
But you've also used the phrase in another title, imperial from the beginning.
Sure.
I thought the framers wanted Congress to be in charge of not just declaring war, but also international commerce. It's a far cry from where we are today.
Well, that's certainly true that Congress is given authority over commerce with foreign nations. And what's happened in modern times is that Congress has delegated lots of lawmaking or discretion to the executive branch on the theory that the president's better able to respond to changing circumstances. The first book described the presidency, and the claim was that the presidency was meant to be a far stronger executive than any previous American executive. And it basically talked about the many authorities the president had, including the veto power, including the power to make treaties, that state governors lacked prior to the Constitution. And so the basic claim is that folks like Jefferson and Adams believed that this president was basically a king in all but name, but not an absolute monarch, a rather limited monarch. And what's happened, I think, over the course of two centuries since then is the president's become more and more absolute and less limited, as the war powers example illustrates.
I'm now going to ration my Arthur Schlesinger citations and put this to both of you. He wrote that presidential power was assumed, or power over, usually involving war making. And he wrote it was as much a matter of congressional abdication as of presidential usurpation. Barbara Perry, has the president become more powerful over time because the Congress has been eager to duck difficult issues?
Well, I think that's part of it, to be sure. And as my colleague Cy indicated, that a lot of power has been delegated, and that in itself becomes a legal issue. You know, can power that's been delegated to the Congress to take certain actions, can it delegate it on to the executive branch? But they certainly are the most related to the political will of the people, especially those in the House of Representatives who were always directly elected by the people and for two-year terms only. So as soon as they get elected, they're running again. So yeah, things like immigration, I think that's what you see.
Cy, I mean, would you agree that it has been that process of delegation that has led to a great deal of the expanded powers of the presidency?
Well, I'd agree with you that it's delegation and ducking. And the ducking part comes from members of Congress understandably not wanting to decide whether to send American troops into harm's way. And I think that sort of the modern understanding of war powers really comes to a head in the Korean War, where President Truman describes the war as a police action and says that, you know, Congress doesn't have a role to play. And there were members of Congress who pushed back. Robert Taft did, for instance. But they were sort of solitary voices. And ever since then, presidents have claimed, well, you know, we've got authority as commander-in-chief to wage war. So it's this reluctance on the part of Congress to assert itself. It's the delegation to the president. And then there's this third, I think, factor, which is the idea that the Constitution's meaning can and ought to change over time.
Okay, let's go to to our listeners right now, starting with Jerry in Kalamazoo, Michigan. Welcome to the program, Jerry.
Hello, thank you.
Sure.
You know, this topic really makes me angry. People should read the Constitution. It begins with we the people. The people should be in charge, and they should be in charge by the 10 sections of Article 1, where the Congress is supposed to be in charge of everything. Then you go to Article 2 about the presidency. There are four sections. The first one is how to become president. The second one is that the president needs approval of Congress. Section 3 is that he must answer to Congress. Mm-hmm. And Section 4 is how the president can be fired by Congress. Now, where exactly is there any presidential power? He was called the president because he was only supposed to preside over the bureaucracy. He was not supposed to have privilege. There's no such thing as privilege in the Constitution. It's only rights.
Well, let's hear from our expert guests. Barbara Perry, is that a fair reading of the Constitution, or is the Constitution Jerry somehow missing the penumbras of the Constitution, as someone once wrote?
Ah, yes, penumbras and emanations.
Emanations.
First of all, there are specific powers that are granted to the president. And I did go back and reread Section 2 yesterday in preparation. So there's the pardon power, obviously, and appointments power and treaty power and to give the State of the Union to Congress. But, you know, we should note that there was no president or executive set up in our first Constitution, which was the Articles of Confederation. And it was clear to most of the founders, particularly Madison, who wrote the second constitution, by and large, that that was not a proper way to try to run a government, that it was failing. And so we can't have just a presider. And the reference to presiding over the bureaucracy, there really was no bureaucracy, at the founding.
Right,
I would agree in part that, yes, obviously, as we've been saying, presidents have assumed a lot of power in because of the Teddy Roosevelt notion of the stewardship theory or activist presidency. But it's not as though Article 2 doesn't grant any powers to the president.
Sai Prakash, do you see Article 2 expressed in the modern presidency?
Well, I agree with my colleague Barbara that Article 2 clearly grants authority to the presidency. The first sentence of Article 2, I think, grants some authority to the president. And then, as Barbara pointed out, Article 2, Section 2 does as well in a whole host of ways. And there's no doubt that the presidency was meant to be stronger than its predecessors in America. But the caller's point, I think, is still somewhat valid in the following sense, that presidents usurp or claim power today that would have been unimaginable to the founders, because we have the sense that whatever the Constitution may have meant before, it doesn't need to mean today. And if that's true with respect to Congress or, say, with respect to rights, it's not surprising that presidents are making the same sort of claim about their executive power.
Speaking of Article 2, in an interview with NPR in December 2016, President Barack Obama was asked about his use of the executive order. He said using executive orders was not his preferred way to get things done, and he offered some advice for then-President-elect Donald Trump.
My suggestion to the president-elect is, going through the legislative process is always better, in part because it's harder to undo. And that doesn't mean, though, that he is not going to come in and look at the various agencies and see the rules we've passed. And if he wants to reverse some of those rules, that's part of the democratic process. That's why I tell people to vote, because it turns out elections mean something.
Chris, there's a big difference between being the president of a global power, the United States of the late 20th and now the 21st century, and being the president of a newly independent bunch of colonies of 3,000 miles away from the great powers. And I think that distinction is one that listener George, who's on the line from Brookline, Massachusetts, would address. Hi, George.
Hi, Robert. My question is simply this. When the president of the United States is referred to as the most powerful man in the world, how can he not think of himself as president of the world? In other words, by virtue of the tremendous power at his disposal, he surely must feel that he can do things that no one else possibly can do in the world or even beyond.
Barbara Perry, is that something, an aspect of the presidency that might be infectious and might convince one of one's powers, even if they're written down no place?
Well, two things come to mind. One is a line from that movie, The American President, where Michael Douglas and Annette Bening are starting their romantic relationship. And Michael Douglas says, well, just want you to remember that, the most powerful man in the world, that's a political distinction. but having said that, the caller from Brookline, Massachusetts, the birthplace of John F. Kennedy, there's a great clip of John F. Kennedy after a year in office who says, there are many more limitations on the power of this office than I really realized before I came into it. So I think, yes, there's some truth in what the caller says. But again, if the checks and balances are working properly, which we hope that they will, there will be some limitations, to be sure, not to mention the political limitations within one's own party or among the people or certainly throughout the world, which Kennedy was facing at the time.
Sai Prakash, is that process, as you see it, probably irreversible? That is, is the power of the presidency something that is unlikely to suddenly become undone in the coming years? Or is it possible that the pendulum will swing back and the presidency will yet be weakened?
It's certainly possible, because we've seen it in the past in American history. I think we've seen in the wake of the impeachment of Andrew Johnson, a chastened presidency, and then certainly after Watergate, Congress enacted a slew of reforms designed to strengthen Congress and weaken the presidency. And so I think if members of Congress could, I think, try to put aside the partisan perspective and not just ask whether the president is of the same party, but instead what will conduce to the long-term health of our democracy and conduce to the power of Congress, they're more likely to think about this systematically.
Sai Krishna Prakash is a law professor at the University of Virginia and author of Imperial from the Beginning, The Constitution of the Original Executive, and the forthcoming The Living Presidency, an Originalist Argument Against Its Ever-Expanding Powers. Great talking with you, Sai. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're discussing the expanding powers of the president. I'm Robert Siegel, and this is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Robert Siegel, and on this President's Day, we're discussing the Office of President and its evolution over time. And with me is Barbara Perry, presidential historian at the University of Virginia's Miller Center. And to get another perspective and on this conversation, joining us now from Los Angeles is John Michaels. He's a law professor at UCLA and author of Constitutional Coup, Privatization's Threat to the American Republic. John, it's wonderful to speak with you today. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Constitutional coup. Who has conducted the coup?
So we've conducted our own coup, as it were. And to kind of tie this into the conversation you all have been having today, I think it's important to recognize that we got tired of checks and balances. We got tired of checks and balances along the lines that Sai Prakash was mentioning. We took competent professional governance for granted and tried to eliminate or streamline much of the friction that's hardwired into our constitutional order. The type of checks and balances that we got tired of that's already been discussed is between Congress and the president. Mm-hmm. It's a dynamic that by design impedes government action. And so in modern times, responding, as was discussed, to the Great Depression and World War II, we allowed tremendous power to shift away from Congress into the executive. And that made for a strong president over national security and intelligence and also over domestic policy, everything from regulating the banking sector to protecting our air and water, our food and drugs. And so what we did was not that we provided a second level of safeguards. So when Congress kind of receded into the background, we developed a professional civil service. And that's kind of what I think is what has been missing from this conversation so far, is that there's another back-end check on a president who reaches as far as any modern president, any imperial president does. And it's supposed to be an intra-executive branch check. And it's not in the Constitution, but neither is a vast administrative state. It's an evolutionary move that we've kind of tinkered with the system as we've gone along. And what's happened is we developed a rather robust bureaucracy that has the legal checks. It has the expertise to kind of push back on a president that's acting in a hyperpartisan or abusive fashion. But fast forward another 30, 40, 50 years, and we've grown tired of those checks and balances as well. Mm-hmm. This is a story that really starts under Ronald Reagan, who declared open war on bureaucrats. But then it was advanced and kind of solidified this move under Bill Clinton. He gave Reagan's initiative bipartisan legitimacy. And he did a great deal to circumvent the civil service by hiring contractors who purportedly were cheaper. They were also more politically pliable. Mm-hmm. And the argument that they were putting forward was that bureaucrats are inefficient and government should run like a business. The problem is government isn't a business, and there's other reasons that a government might fire an employee other than the bottom line, which is political disagreements or programmatic disagreements. And that's what we're seeing today. So now we have a president who presides over not a very deep state, a quite shallow state that's been depleted, often demoralized over decades. So we get a President Trump who has sidelined key climate change scientists. He's pushed aside immigration judges.
Hurricane maps, hurricane forecast, yeah. Barbara Perry...
Even before that, when he got into office, they kind of cleaned house with the folks who were in the various agencies who were the most prominent and most competent climate change scientists. This was not dead weight they were clearing out. These were people they recognized would be a thorn in their side if they were going to undermine the climate change regulation.
Well, I'd like to hear from Barbara, because we're not talking about any article of the Constitution right now, but what John's describing is a change in the authority of the president and an increase in that authority over the what President Trump supporters would call the deep state. John says it's rather shallow, but
Well, I'm so glad that John has joined us to bring that perspective, because we hadn't talked about bureaucracy, and in fact we had mentioned that FDR and the growth of the administrative state, particularly under him. But again, you can even go back to his distant cousin Teddy Roosevelt to see that in the early 20th century. And so I hadn't really thought in terms of that the Ronald Reagan line from his first inaugural that in the current crisis, which was the economic crisis of the Carter years, he said famously or infamously, depending on one point of view, government isn't the solution to our problems. Government is the problem. And then that kind of third way moderate approach of Bill Clinton and the technocratic Al Gore turning the bureaucracy into a business. And then the next step, which is the Donald Trump step to complain about the deep state or even if it's shallow. But I just have to list one thing here that always concerns me about this anti-government, anti-bureaucratic view is that I was at the Supreme Court as a fellow in April of 1995 when the word came on the bench. It actually came to the bench during an oral argument that the bombing had occurred of the Oklahoma City Federal Building. Mm-hmm. And my thought about that always was that, you know, when we have this view that the bureaucrats are bad and government is bad, you get people who are not quite mentally stable and they actually become murderous towards them. And I always think that that's a very sad movement in our country.
Well, I want to put a question to both of you, starting with John, and that is in the well, this would have been a hypothetical a few years ago, but the president says, I can tell the attorney general what to investigate or whether to review these sentencing recommendations for my friend. I think we'd all agree that there'd be a case for guardrails or for staff to tell him, you know, that's really contrary to what presidents have done and where they've seen limits over the years. But legally, constitutionally, does he have the authority to do that?
So constitutionally, he does. And that's why I was emphasizing that we've developed constitutional conventions that surround the text, that surround the meaning, and that make more sense as our constitutional order evolves as it has. So what you might see in a situation like that, and what maybe perhaps we will see still, is resistance from within the bureaucracy. Mm-hmm. And we had that the story you're telling in part, we have a forerunner to William Barr, and that was John Ashcroft. And there's that famous or infamous moment where the national security folks were rushing to his hospital bed to get him to sign off on an intelligence surveillance program. And other career officials were coming along the other path and threatening to resign if he goes ahead and does this without vetting it along the proper kind of legal channels. And we've had moments, and it is sad, and I agree that it puts a lot of pressure on civil servants who don't get any financial rewards, don't get recognized in history books for what they do. It puts a lot of pressure on people to, like these four prosecutors in the Roger Stone case, mm-hmm. to put country over over even the peace and security that that may be threatened right now, given the climate we live in. But it does. Mm-hmm. We do have a culture where we have professional employees and professional government servants who could say, look, Attorney General, if you're going to do this, I can't be a part of this. I wash my hands of it. And if enough of those people do it, and enough of the people do it in a position of some influence, one, it could incapacitate the Attorney General to carry out his mission. But more importantly, it puts more and more pressure, say, on the Senate to do its first order separation of powers job or checks and balances job and say, how long can we tolerate this?
But like, Barbara would...
But
I'm just wondering from Barbara Perry, bottom line, can the president do it?
I think John is correct, and everything that I've read, I'm not a lawyer, but everything I've read from the lawyers and constitutional lawyers is that, yes, he can technically, but we should remember that many of those checks and congressional checks and DOJ checks came along after Watergate in an attempt to limit the president and the kind of abuse of power Nixon engaged in during Watergate.
Well, joining us now is Ari, who is calling from New Orleans. Hi.
Hi. So I think that the structure that the Constitution has given us for the executive and the presidency and Congress reveals a lot about their purpose and where the power should lie. The president is a single individual, and so is by its nature, it's a non-deliberative body. The president makes decisions. The president obviously should think about them, but his spur of the moment can respond immediately to situations, national emergencies, flares of violence, conflict across the globe, etc. But the Congress is a deliberative body. It's made up of now 535 members. It has debate built into its very structure. It's ponderous. It's designed to move slowly because it's designed to consider all of the issues. And so I think that in terms of the issue of presidential power versus congressional power, I think Congress is really should be given almost all of the power in dealing with any sort of long-range complex issue. And the president's power should really be limited to dealing with situations that require immediate attention and then being turned over to Congress as soon as that immediate need is passed.
Well, let's hear what our guests think about that, John. John Michaels, a sensible division of labor?
A sensible division of labor at the time of the founding. In a world as complex as ours, the framework laid out by the founders doesn't necessarily work. It wouldn't be responsive in all the ways that we need in a society in which we have industrialization and post-industrialization, in a polity that is much more inclusive and has to be responsive to marginalized communities in a way that the framers never anticipated that to be. We have a standing army because the world's dangerous. The framers didn't anticipate a standing army. We have an administrative state because the world is nasty and rough, and there's pollution, and there's labor, there's wage theft and everything else. So power has to shift to someone who's a little bit more decisive, as the caller mentioned. And then the question is, how do we respond to that power shift? And if we sit on our heels and say, well, the Constitution doesn't really say much about restricting presidential power, we are opening ourselves up for a dangerous situation such as we find ourselves today. We need to create back-end layers of checks, and we need to hold people personally responsible, even if they're not legally responsible, by allowing the historians to basically cast judgment and say this is shameful behavior and whatnot.
Barbara Perry, that's your cue. You're the historian.
Yes, indeed. Well, I would say in recent history, the caller is correct if we look at these two examples. And one is the difference between how Congress attempted to handle the complexity of the Clinton health care, where they just were sort of presented with it from Mrs. Clinton's commission to put it together. And that didn't go so well. It didn't pass. But when the Obama administration said, well, that didn't work, let's see if the Congress can come up with something for whatever one's views of ACA, they did come up with something. Mm-hmm. So the president sort of launched the concept, this is what we're going to do. It took it to the Congress. Congress put together legislation, passed on partisan lines, but it did pass. So the caller's concept, I think, came true there. But John is right that there's so much other complexity, particularly in foreign affairs, that it's difficult to carry that out.
Another call from Joseph this time. He's in Westport, Massachusetts. Hi, Joseph.
Hi. My question is a reaction from your guests about the role of the presidency for a reactive versus a proactive role. And an example being with the Depression, we had social and economic reforms. We had development of the WPA. We had infrastructure improvements. And with the world wars, we had with Eisenhower education and housing and policies retrofitting America for the future. But today we have the issue of climate change and the never-ending imperial expansion and war.
And it's a different dynamic, because I think you've spoken about the presidency, the Senate, the House, but you've left out corporations and their role in sort of gauging the future policies. And I'm wondering, where is the balance to confront these issues, and in a day of this day with a divided Congress, and also the politicization of politics? How can we address, you know, these future issues that are going to require us to work on a global scale and have a national sort of policy to address it?
Well, let's turn to John Michaels and hear what he has to say.
So I do think that's a really important point, and it challenges our understanding of democracy writ large. The idea of kind of growing concentrated economic power, and how does that play a role? It may limit the extent to which we can put faith in kind of democracy being responsive in the way or leaders being responsive in the way we think they should be, and it poses challenges if their agenda is different from ours. At various points, we've had an imperfect democracy along different valences, and the one we really need to confront today is, I think, the one that's been identified, which is concentrated corporate power and how that plays out. In some ways, it counsels in favor of greater executive power. If indeed it's harder to capture it's harder for corporate interests to capture a president who represents the nation, the whole nation, as opposed to, let's say a Senate committee or a House Appropriations Committee, which can really get bottled up relatively easily. So that once again, I think, points to the temptation among, again, Democratic or Republican presidents to take whatever power that's left on the table and run with it before things get bottled up in a Congress that's maybe responsive to the wrong cues.
That's John Michaels, a professor at UCLA's School of Law and author of Constitutional Coup, A Privatization's Threat to the American Republic. Thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you.
And Barbara Perry, I wonder, having written about so many presidents and studied the presidency, we're now at a time when, not just in the United States, but in a few European countries, people have rejected all of the conventional options out there. And they've said neither of these traditional approaches to government seems to be addressing the problems that we face. In America, we've seen that contributing to a lot of support for Donald Trump and to a self-declared revolutionary, Bernie Sanders. And I just wonder whether you ever get the sense that that people could be disaffected enough concede certain democratic authorities. I've left you all of 30 seconds to answer that question. I'm sorry.
But, yes, that's quite all right. Our next book that I'm editing with my colleague Michael Nelson is called The Presidency at a Crossroads, and we're going to address that very question, Robert. And one of the things we point to is the populist movement around the world, and by definition, whether it's from the left or the right, is anti-elite. And our presidency has become an elite institution, and so oftentimes people are against it as an institution.
Sad to say
on President's Day.
Okay. Barbara Perry is a presidential historian and director of presidential studies at the University of Virginia. Barbara, great to have you on today.
Great to be with you, Robert.
And you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. On this President's Day, I'm Robert Siegel, and this is On Point.